came just as he was heading down the ramp from 7 to level 8, along the side of one of the cathedral-huge unfinished caverns where the raw ice of the moon had been left to weep and refreeze, something between a massive green space and a work of art. There was a flash, then a concussion, and the scooter was fishtailing. The wall loomed up fast, and Prax wrenched his leg out of the way before the impact. Above him, he heard voices shouting. Combat troops would be in armor, talking through their radios. At least he thought they would. The people screaming up there had to be just people. A second explosion gouged the cavern wall, a section of blue-white ice the size of a tractor calving off the roof and falling slowly and inexorably down to the floor, grinding into it. Prax scrambled to keep the scooter upright. His heart felt like it was trying to break out of his ribcage. On the upper edge of the curving ramp, he saw figures in armor. He didn't know if they were UN or Mars. One of them turned toward him, lifting a rifle. Prax gunned the scooter, sliding fast down the ramp. The chatter of automatic weapons and the smell of smoke and steam melt followed him. The school's doors were closed. He didn't know if that was ominous or hopeful. He brought the wobbling scooter to a halt, jumped off. His legs felt weak and unsteady. He meant to knock gently on the steel drop door, but his first try split the skin over his knuckle. "Open up! My daughter's in there!" He sounded like a madman, but someone inside heard him or saw him on the security monitor. The articulated steel plates of the door shuddered and began to rise. Prax dropped to the ground and scrambled through. He hadn't met the new teacher, Miss Carey, more than a few times, when dropping May off or picking her up. She couldn't have been more than 20 years old, and was belter tall and thin. He didn't remember her face being so gray. The schoolroom was intact, though. The children were in a circle, singing a song about an ant traveling through the solar system with rhymes for all the major asteroid bodies. There was no blood, no bullet holes, but the smell of burning plastic was seeping through the vents. He had to get May someplace safe. He wasn't sure where that would be. He looked at the circle of children, trying to pick out her face, her hair. "May's not here, sir," Miss Carey said, her voice tight and breathy at the same time. "Her mother got her this morning." "This morning," Prax said. But his mind fastened on her mother. What was Nicola doing on Ganymede? He'd had a message from her 2 days earlier about the child support judgment. She couldn't have gotten from Ceres to Ganymede in 2 days. "Just after snack," the teacher said. "You mean she was evacuated? Someone came and evacuated May." Another explosion came, shaking the ice. One of the children made a high, frightened sound. The teacher looked from him to the children, then back. When she spoke again, her voice was lower. "Her mother came just after snack. She took May with her. She hasn't been here all day." Prax pulled up his hand terminal. The connection was still dead, but his wallpaper was a picture from May's first birthday, back when things were still good, lifetimes ago. He held up the picture and pointed at Nicola, laughing and dangling the doughy, delighted bundle that had been May. "Her?" Prax said. "She was here?" The confusion in the teacher's face answered him. There'd been a mistake. Someone, a new nanny or a social worker or something, had come to pick up a kid and gotten the wrong one. "She was on the computer," the teacher said. "She was in the system. It showed her." The lights flickered. The smell of smoke was getting stronger. and the air recyclers were humming loudly, popping and crackling as they struggled to suck out the volatile particulates. A boy, whose name Prak should have known, whimpered, and the teacher reflexively tried to turn toward him. Prax took her elbow and wrenched her back. "No, you made a mistake," he said. "Who did you give May to?" "The system said it was her mother. She had identification. It cleared her." A stutter of muted gunfire came from the hallway. Someone was screaming outside. And then the kids started to shriek. The teacher pulled her arm away. Something banged against the drop door. "She was about 30. Dark hair, dark eyes. She had a doctor with her. She was in the system, and May didn't make any kind of fuss about it." "Did they take her medicine?" he asked. "Did they take her medicine?" "No, I don't know, I don't think so." Without meaning to, Prax shook the woman. Only once, but hard. If May didn't have her medicine, she'd already missed her midday dose. She might make it as long as morning before her immune system started shutting down. "Show me," Prax said. "Show me the picture, the woman who took her." "I can't. The system's down," the teacher shouted. "They're killing people in the hallway." The circle of children dissolved, screams riding on the backs of screams. The teacher was crying, her hands pressed to her face. Her skin had an almost blue cast to it. He could feel the raw animal panic leaping through his brain. The calm that fell on him didn't take away from it. "Is there an evacuation tunnel?" he asked. "They told us to stay here," the teacher said. "I'm telling you to evacuate," Prak said. But what he thought was, "I have to find May." Chapter 4. Bobby. Consciousness returned as an angry buzzing noise and pain. Bobby blinked once, trying to clear her head, trying to see where she was. Her vision was maddeningly blurry. The buzzing sound resolved into an alarm from her suit. Colored lights flashed in her face as the suit's HUD sent her data she couldn't read. It was in the middle of rebooting, and alarms were coming on one by one. She tried to move her arms and found that although weak, she wasn't paralyzed or frozen in place. The impact gel in her suit had returned to a liquid state. Something moved across the window of faint light that was her helmet's face shield, a head bobbing in and out of view. Then a click as someone plugged a hard line into her suit's external port. A corpsman then, downloading her injury data. A voice, male and young, in her suit's internal speakers said, "Gotcha, Gunny. We gotcha. Gonna be okay. Gonna be all right. Just hang in there." He hadn't quite finished saying "there" when she blacked out again. She woke, bouncing down a long white tunnel on a stretcher. She wasn't wearing her suit anymore. Bobby was afraid that the battlefield medtechs hadn't wasted time taking her out of it the normal way, that they just hit the override that blew all the seams and joints apart. It was a fast way to get a wounded soldier out of 400 kilos of armored exoskeleton, but the suit was destroyed in the process. Bobby felt a pang of remorse for the loss of her faithful old suit. A moment later, she remembered that her entire platoon had been ripped to pieces before her eyes, and her sadness about the lost suit seemed trivial and demeaning. A hard bump on the stretcher sent a jolt of lightning up her spine and hurled her back into darkness. "Sergeant Draper," a voice said. Bobby tried to open her eyes and found it impossible to do. Each eyelid weighed 1,000 kilos, and even the attempt left her exhausted. So she tried to answer the voice, and was surprised and a little ashamed of the drunken mumble that came out instead.
"She's conscious, but just barely," the voice said.
It was a deep, mellow, male voice. It seemed filled with warmth and concern. Bobby hoped that the voice would keep talking until she fell back asleep. A second voice, female and sharp, replied, "Let her rest. Trying to bring her fully awake right now is dangerous." The kind voice said,
"I don't care if it kills her, doctor. I need to speak to this soldier, and I need to do it now. So you give her whatever you need to give her to make that happen."
Bobby smiled to herself, not parsing the words the nice voice said, just the kindly, warm tone. It was good to have someone like that to take care of you. She started to fall back asleep. The coming blackness, a welcome friend. White fire shot up Bobby's spine, and she sat bolt upright in bed, as awake as she'd ever been. It felt like going on the juice, the chemical cocktail they gave sailors to keep them conscious and alert during high-G maneuvers. Bobby opened her eyes and then slammed them shut again when the room's bright white light nearly burned them out of her sockets.
"Turn off the lights," she mumbled, the words coming out of her dry throat in a whisper.
The red light seeping in through her closed eyelids dimmed, but when she tried to open them again, it was still too bright. Someone took her hand and held it while a cup was put into it.
"Can you hold that?" the nice voice said.
Bobby didn't answer. She just brought the cup to her mouth and drank the water in two greedy swallows.
"More," she said,
this time in something resembling her old voice. She heard the sounds of someone scooting a chair, and then footsteps away from her on a tile floor. Her brief look at the room had told her she was in a hospital. She could hear the electric hum of medical machines nearby, and the smells of antiseptic and urine competed for dominance. Disheartened, she realized she was the source of the urine smell. A faucet ran for a moment, and then the footsteps came toward her. The cup was put back into her hand. She sipped at it this time, letting the water stay in her mouth a while before swallowing. It was cool and delicious. When she was finished, the voice asked,
"More?"
She shook her head.
"Maybe later," she said.
Then, after a moment,
"Am I blind?"
"No. You've been given a combination of focused drugs and powerful amphetamines, which means your eyes are fully dilated.
Sorry. I didn't think to lower the lights before you woke up."
The voice was still filled with kindness and warmth. Bobby wanted to see the face behind that voice, so she risked squinting through one eye. The light didn't burn into her like it had before, but it was still uncomfortable. The owner of the nice voice turned out to be a very tall, thin man in a naval intelligence uniform. His face was narrow and tight, the skull beneath it pressing to get out.
"Gunnery Sergeant Roberta W. Draper, 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force," he said, his voice so at odds with his appearance that Bobby felt like she was watching a movie dubbed from a foreign language. After several seconds, he still hadn't continued, so Bobby said,
"Yes, sir."
Then glanced at his bars and added,
"Captain."
She could open both eyes now, without pain, but a strange tingling sensation was moving up her limbs, making them feel numb and shaky at the same time. She resisted an urge to fidget.
"Sergeant Draper, my name is Captain Thorson, and I am here to debrief you. We've lost your entire platoon. There's been a 2-day pitched battle
between the United Nations and Martian Congressional Republic forces on Ganymede, which, at most recent tally, has resulted in over 5 billion MCR dollars of infrastructure damage and the deaths of nearly 3,000 military and civilian personnel. He paused again, staring at her through narrowed eyes that glittered like a snake's. Not sure what response he was looking for, Bobby just said, "Yes, sir." "Sergeant Draper, why did your platoon fire on and destroy the UN military outpost at Dome 14? This question was so nonsensical that Bobby's mind spent several seconds trying to figure out what it really meant. "Who ordered you to commence firing? And why?" Of course, he couldn't be asking why her people had started the fight. Didn't he know about the monster? "Don't you know about the monster?" Captain Thorson didn't move, but the corners of his mouth dropped into a frown, and his forehead bunched up over his nose. "Monster," he said, none of the warmth gone from his voice. "Sir, some kind of monster, mutant, something attacked the UN outpost. The UN troops were running to us to escape it. We didn't fire on them. This whatever it was killed them. And then it killed us," she said, nauseated and pausing to swallow at the lemony taste in her mouth. "I mean, everyone but me." Thorson frowned for a moment, then reached into one pocket and took out a small digital recorder. He turned it off, then set it on a tray next to Bobby's bed. "Sergeant, I'm going to give you a second chance. Up to now, your record has been exemplary. You're a fine Marine, one of our best. Would you like to start over?" He picked up the recorder and placed a finger on the delete button while giving her a knowing look. "You think I'm lying?" she said. The itchy feeling in her limbs resolved itself into a very real urge to reach out and snap the smug bastard's arm off at the elbow. "We all shot at it. There will be gun camera footage from the entire platoon of this thing killing UN soldiers and then attacking us, sir." Thorson shook his hatchet-shaped head at her, narrowing his eyes until they almost disappeared. "We have no transmissions from the platoon for the entire fight, and no uploaded data." "They were jamming," Bobby interrupted. "I lost my radio link when I got close to the monster, too." Thorson continued as though she had not spoken. "And all of the local hardware was lost when an orbital mirror array fell onto the dome. You were outside of the impact area, but the shockwave threw you nearly another quarter of a kilometer. It took us some time to find you." "All of the local hardware was lost." Such a sterile way of putting it. Everyone in Bobby's platoon blown into shrapnel and vapor when a couple thousand tons of mirror fell out of orbit onto them. A monitor started sounding a low, chiming alert, but no one else paid it any attention, so she didn't either. "My suit, sir. I shot at it too. My video will still be there." "Yes," Thorson said. "We've examined your suit's video log. It's nothing but static." This is like a bad horror movie, she thought. The heroine who sees the monster, but no one will believe her. She imagined the second act in which she was court-martialed in disgrace and only got her redemption in the third act when the monster showed up again and killed everyone who didn't believe. "Wait," she said. "What decompression did you use?" "My suit is an older model. It uses the version 5.1 video compression. Tell the tech that and have them try it again." Thorson stared at her for a few moments, then pulled out his hand terminal and called someone. "Have Sergeant Draper's combat suit brought up to her room. Send a tech with video gear with it." He put the terminal away and then gave Bobby another of those frightening smiles.
Sergeant, I admit that I am extremely curious about what you want me to see. If this is still a ruse of some kind, you've only bought yourself a few more moments.
Bobby didn't reply, but her reaction to Thorson's attitude had finally shifted from frightened, through angry, to annoyed. She pushed herself up in the narrow hospital bed and turned sideways, sitting on the edge and tossing the blanket to the side. With her size, her physical presence up close usually either frightened men or turned them on. Either way, it made them uncomfortable. She leaned toward Thorson a bit and was rewarded when he pushed his chair back an equal amount. She could tell from his disgusted expression that he immediately knew what she'd done, and he looked away from her smile. The door to the room opened, and a pair of navy techs wheeled in her suit on a rack. It was intact. They hadn't wrecked it, taking her out. She felt a lump come up in her throat and swallowed it back down. She wasn't going to show even a moment's weakness in front of this Thorson clown. The clown pointed at the senior of the two techs and said, "You, what's your name?" The young tech snapped off a salute and said, "Petty Officer Electrician's Mate Singh, sir." "Mr. Singh, Sergeant Draper here is claiming that her suit has a different video compression than the new suits, and that's why you are unable to read her video data. Is this correct?" Singh slapped himself on the forehead with his palm. "Shit, yeah," he said. "I didn't think. This is the old Mark III Goliath suit. When they started making the Mark IV, they completely rewrote the firmware. Totally different video storage system. Wow, I feel pretty stupid."
"Yes," interrupted Thorson. "Do whatever you need to do to display the video stored on that suit. The sooner you do, the less time I will have to dwell on the delays caused by incompetence."
Singh, to his credit, did not reply. He immediately plugged the suit into a monitor and began working. Bobby examined her suit. It had a lot of scratches and dings, but appeared otherwise undamaged. She felt a strong urge to put it on, and then tell Thorson where he could stick his attitude. A new set of shakes moved up her arms and legs. Something fluttered in her neck, like the heartbeat of a small animal. She reached up and touched it. It was her pulse. She started to say something, but the tech was pumping his fist and high-fiving his assistant.
"Got it, sir," Singh said, then began the playback.
Bobby tried to watch, but the picture kept getting fuzzy. She reached for Thorson's arm to get his attention, but missed somehow, and just kept tipping forward.
"Here we go again," she thought,
and there was a brief moment of free fall before the blackness.
"God damn it," the sharp voice said. "I goddamn well told you this would happen. This soldier has suffered internal injuries and a nasty concussion. You can't just pump her full of speed and then interrogate her. It's irresponsible. It's fucking criminal."
Bobby opened her eyes. She was back in bed. Thorson sat in the chair by her side. A stocky, blonde woman in hospital scrubs stood at the foot of her bed, her face flushed and furious. When she saw Bobby was awake, she moved to her side and took her hand.
"Sergeant Draper, don't try to move. You took a fall and aggravated some of your injuries. We've got you stabilized, but you need to rest now."
The doctor looked up at Thorson as she said it, her face placing exclamation marks after every sentence. Bobby nodded at her, which made her head feel like a bowl of water being carried in shifting gravity. That it didn't hurt probably meant they'd shot her full of every pain medication they had.
"Sergeant Draper's assistance was crucial," Thorson said, not a hint of apology in his lovely voice. "Because of it, she may have just saved us from an all-out shooting war with Earth."
Risking one's own life so others don't have to is pretty much the definition of Roberta's job.
Don't call me Roberta, Bobby mumbled.
Gunny, Thorson said, I'm sorry about what happened to your team. But mostly I'm sorry for not believing you. Thank you for responding with professionalism. We avoided a serious mistake because of it.
Just thought you were an asshole, Bobby said.
That's my job, soldier. Thorson stood up.
Get some rest. We're shipping you out as soon as you're well enough for the trip.
Shipping me out? Back to Mars?
Thorson didn't answer. He nodded to the doctor, then left.
The doctor pushed a button on one of the machines near Bobby's bed, and something cool shot into her arm. The lights went out. Gelatin. Why do hospitals always serve gelatin? Bobby desultorily poked her spork at the quivering mound of green on her plate. She was finally feeling good enough to really eat, and the soft and see-through foods they kept bringing her were growing more unsatisfying. Even the high-protein, high-carbohydrate slop they cranked out on most Navy ships sounded good right then, or a thick mushroom steak covered in gravy with a side of couscous. The door to her room slid open, and her doctor, who she now knew was named Tricia Pichon, but who insisted that everyone called her Dr. Trish, came in along with Captain Thorson and a new man she didn't know. Thorson gave her his creepy smile, but Bobby had learned that it was just the way the man's face worked. He seemed to lack the muscles necessary for normal smiling. The new man wore a Marine chaplain's uniform of indeterminate religious affiliation. Dr. Trish spoke first.
Good news, Bobby. We're turning you loose tomorrow. How do you feel?
Fine. Hungry, Bobby said, then gave her gelatin another stab.
We'll see about getting you some real food then, Dr. Trish said, then smiled and left the room.
Thorson pointed at the chaplain. This is Captain Martins. He'll be coming with us on our trip. I'll leave you two to get acquainted. Thorson left before Bobby could respond, and Martins plopped himself down in the chair next to her bed. He stuck out his hand, and she shook it.
Hello, Sergeant, he said. When I marked my 2790 form as none for religious faith, I was serious about that, Bobby said, cutting him off.
Martins smiled, apparently not offended by her interruption or her agnosticism.
I'm not here in a religious capacity, Sergeant. I'm also a trained grief counselor. And since you witnessed the death of every person in your unit and were almost killed yourself, Captain Thorson and your doctor agree that you might need me.
Bobby started to make a dismissive reply, which was cut off by the lump in her chest. She hid her discomfort by taking a long drink of water, then said,
I'm fine. Thanks for coming by.
Martins leaned back in the chair, his smile never wavering.
If you were really all right after what you've been through, it would be a sign that something was wrong.
And you're about to be thrown into a situation with a lot of emotional and intellectual pressure. Once we get to Earth, you won't have the luxury of having an emotional breakdown or post-traumatic stress responses. We have a lot of work to...
Earth?
Bobby pounced on the word.
Wait a minute.
Why am I going to Earth?
Chapter 5. Avasarala. Christian Avasarala, assistant to the Undersecretary of Executive Administration, sat near the end of the table. Her sari was orange, the only splash of color in the otherwise military blue and gray of the meeting. The seven others with seats at the table
were the heads of their respective branches of the United Nations military forces, all of them men. She knew their names, their career paths and psychological profiles, pay rates and political alliances, and who they were sleeping with. Against the back wall, personal assistants and staff pages stood in uncomfortable stillness, like the shy teenagers at a dance. Avasarala snuck a pistachio out of her purse, cracked the shell discreetly, and popped the salted nut into her mouth. Any meeting with Martian Command is going to have to wait until after the situation on Ganymede is stabilized. Official diplomatic talks before then are only going to make it seem like we've accepted the new status quo. That was Admiral Nguyen, youngest of the men present. Hawkish, impressed with himself in the way that successful young men tended to be. General Adiki Sandoval nodded his bull-wide head.
Agreed. It's not just Mars we need to think about here. If we start looking weak to the Outer Planets Alliance, you can count on a spike in terrorist activity.
Michael Agee, from the Diplomatic Corps, leaned back on his chair and licked his lips anxiously. His slicked back hair and pinched face made him look like an anthropomorphic rat. Gentlemen, I have to disagree.
Of course you do,
General Nettleford said dryly. Agee ignored him. Meeting with Mars at this point is a necessary first step. If we start throwing around preconditions and obstacles, not only is this process going to take longer, but the chances for renewed hostilities go up. If we can take the pressure off, blow off some steam. Admiral Nguyen nodded, his face expressionless. When he spoke, his tone was conversational. Do you guys over at DIP have any metaphors more recent than the steam engine? Avasarala chuckled with the others. She didn't think much of AG either.
Mars has already escalated, General Nettleford said. Seems to me our best move at this point is to pull the Seventh back from Ceres Station, get them burning, put a ticking clock on the wall, then see if the Martians want to stand back on Ganymede.
Are you talking about moving them to the Jovian system? Nguyen asked. Or are you taking them in toward Mars?
Taking something in toward Earth looks a lot like taking it in toward Mars, Nettleford said.
Avasarala cleared her throat.
Do you have anything new on the initial attacker? She asked.
The tech guys are working on it, Nettleford said. But that makes my point. If Mars is testing out new technologies on Ganymede, we can't afford to let them control the tempo. We have to get a threat of our own on the board.
It was the protomolecule, though?
AG asked. I mean, it was whatever was on Eros when it went down?
Working on that, Nettleford said again, biting at the words a little. There are some gross similarities, but there's some basic differences, too. It didn't spread the way it did on Eros. Ganymede isn't changing the way the population of Eros did. From the satellite imagery we've got, it looks like it went to Martian territory and either self-destructed or was disposed of by their side. If it's related to Eros at all, it's been refined.
So Mars got a sample and weaponized it, Admiral Souther said. He didn't talk much. Avasarala always forgot how high his voice was.
One possibility, Nettleford said. One very strong possibility.
Look, Nguyen said with a self-satisfied little smile, like a child who knew he was going to get his way. I know we've taken first strike off the table here, but we need to talk about what the limits are on immediate response. If this was a dry run for something bigger, waiting may be as good as walking out an airlock.
We should take the meeting with Mars, Avasarala said.
The room went quiet. Nguyen's face darkened.
Is that, he said, but never finished the sentence.
Avasarala watched the men look at each other. She took another pistachio from her purse, ate the meat, and tucked the shells away. A.G. tried not to look pleased. She really did need to find out who had pulled strings to have him represent the diplomatic corps. It was a terrible choice.
Security's going to be a problem, Nettleford said. We're not letting any of their ships inside our effective defense perimeter.
Well, we can't have it on their terms. If we're going to do this, we want them here, where we control the ground.
Park them a safe distance away and have our transports pick them up?
They'll never agree to that.
So let's find out what they will agree to.
Abasarala quietly stood up and headed for the door. Her personal assistant, a European boy named Soren Kotwold, detached himself from the back wall and followed her. The generals pretended not to notice her exit, or maybe they were so wrapped up in the new set of problems she'd handed them they really didn't. Either way, she was sure they were as pleased to have her out as she was to leave. The hallways of the United Nations complex in The Hague were clean and wide, the decor a soft style that made everything look like a museum diorama of Portuguese colonies in the 1940s. She paused at an organics recycling unit and started digging the shells out of her bag.
What's next? She asked.
Debriefing with Mr. Ehrenreich.
After that?
Mr. Gravis about the Afghanistan problem?
Cancel it.
What should I tell them?
Abasarala dusted her hands over the waste container, then turned, walking briskly toward the central commons and the elevators.
Fuck him, she said. Tell him the Afghanis have been resisting external rule since before my ancestors were kicking out the British. As soon as I figure out how to change that, I'll let him know.
Yes, ma'am.
I also need an updated summary paper on Venus, the latest. And I don't have time to get another PhD to read it, so if it's not in clear, concise language, fire the son of a bitch and get someone who knows how to write.
Yes, ma'am.
The elevator that rose from the common lobby and meeting rooms up to the offices glittered like spun diamond set in steel and was big enough to seat dinner for four. It recognized them as they stepped in and began its careful rise through the levels. Outside the windows of the common areas, the Binnenhof seemed to sink, and the huge anthill of buildings that was The Hague spread out under a perfect blue sky. It was springtime, and the snow that had touched the city since December was finally gone. The pigeons swirled up from the streets far below. There were 30 billion people on the planet, but they would never crowd out the pigeons.
They're all fucking men, she said.
Excuse me?
Soren said.
The generals, they're all fucking men.
I thought Souther was the only.
I don't mean that they all fuck men, I mean they're all men, the fuckers. How long has it been since a woman was in charge of the armed forces?
Not since I came here.
So instead we wind up with another example of what happens to policy when there's too much testosterone in the room.
That reminds me. Get in touch with Annette Rabir in infrastructure. I don't trust Nguyen. If traffic starts going up between him and anyone in the General Assembly, I want to know it.
Soren cleared his throat.
Excuse me, ma'am, did you just instruct me to spy on Admiral Nguyen?
No, I just asked for a comprehensive audit of all network traffic, and I don't give a fuck about any results besides Nguyen's office.
Of course, my mistake. The elevator rose past the windows, past the view of the city, and into the dark shaft of the private office levels. Avasarala cracked her knuckles.
Just in case, though, she said. Do it on your own initiative.
Yes, ma'am. That was my thought, too.
To those who knew Avasarala only by reputation, her office was deceptively unassuming. It was on the east side of the building, where the lower-ranked officials usually started out. She had a window looking out over the city, but not a corner. The video screen that took up most of the southern wall was left off when it wasn't in active use, leaving it matte black. The other walls were scuffed bamboo paneling. The carpet was industrially short and patterned to hide stains. The only decorations were a small shrine with a clay sculpture of the Gautama Buddha beside the desk, and a cut crystal vase with the flowers that her husband Arjun sent every Thursday. The place smelled like fresh blooms and old pipe smoke, though Avasarala had never smoked there and didn't know anyone who had. She walked to the window. Beneath her, the city spread out in vast concrete and ancient stone. In the darkening sky, Venus burned. In the 12 years she had been at this desk, in this room, everything had changed. The alliance between Earth and its upstart brother had been an eternal, unshakable thing once. The belt had been an annoyance and a haven for tiny cells of renegades and troublemakers, as likely to die of a ship malfunction as to be called to justice. Humanity had been alone in the universe. And then, the secret discovery that Phoebe, idiosyncratic moon of Saturn, had been an alien weapon, launched at Earth when life here was hardly more than an interesting idea wrapped in a lipid bilayer. How could anything be the same after that? And yet, it was. Yes, Earth and Mars were still unsure whether they were permanent allies or deadly enemies. Yes, the OPA, Hezbollah of the Vacuum, was on its way to being a real political force in the outer planets. Yes, the thing that had been meant to reshape the primitive biosphere of Earth had instead ridden a rogue asteroid down into the clouds of Venus and started doing no one knew what. But the spring still came. The election cycle still rose and fell. The evening star still lit the indigo heavens, outshining even the greatest cities of Earth. Other days, she found that reassuring. "Mr. Ehrenreich," Soren said. Avasarala turned to the dead screen on her wall as it came to life. Satavir Ehrenreich was darker skinned than she was, his face round and soft. It would have been in place anywhere in the Punjab, but his voice affected the cool, analytic amusement of Britain. He wore a dark suit and a smart, narrow tie. Wherever he was, it was bright daylight behind him. The link kept fluttering, trying to balance the bright with the dark, leaving him a shadow in a government office or else a man haloed by light. "Your meeting went well, I hope." "It was fine," she said. "We're moving ahead with the Martian summit. They're working out the security arrangements now." "That was the consensus?" "Once I told them it was, yes. The Martians are sending their top men to a meeting with officials of the United Nations to personally deliver their apology and discuss how to normalize relations and return Ganymede to blah, blah, blah. Yes?" Ehrenreich scratched his chin. "I'm not sure that's how our opposites on Mars see it," he said. "Then they can protest. We'll send out dueling press releases and threaten to cancel the meeting right up to the last minute. High drama is wonderful. It's better than wonderful. It's distracting. Just don't let the bubblehead talk about Venus or Eros." His flinch was almost subliminal. "Please, can we not refer to the Secretary General as the bobblehead?" "Why not? He knows I do. I say it to his face and he doesn't mind." "He thinks you're joking." "That's because he's a fucking bobblehead. Don't let him talk about Venus." "And the footage?" It was a fair question. Whatever had made its attack on Ganymede, it had started in the area held by the United Nations. If the back-channel chatter was to be trusted, and it wasn't, Mars had a lone marine suit camera.
Avasarala had 7 minutes of high-definition video from 40 different cameras of the thing slaughtering the best people Earth had standing for it. Even if the Martians could be convinced to keep it quiet, this was going to be hard to bury.
"Give me until the meeting," Avasarala said. "Let me see what they say and how they say it. Then I'll know what to do. If it's a Martian weapon, they'll show it by what they bring to the table."
"I see," Aaron Wright said slowly, meaning he didn't.
"Sir, with all respect," she said, "for the time being, this needs to be something between Earth and Mars. High drama between the two major military forces in the system is what we want. How exactly do you see that?"
"I got an alert from Michael John de Outerbay about increased activity on Venus at the same time the shooting started on Ganymede. It wasn't a big spike, but it was there. And Venus getting restless just when something happens that looks a damn lot like the protomolecule showed up on Ganymede? That's a problem."
She let that sink in for a moment before she went on. Aaron Wright's eyes shifted, like he was reading in the air. It was something he did when he was thinking hard.
"Saber rattling we've done before," she said. "We've survived it. It's a known quantity. I have a binder with 900 pages of analysis and contingency plans for conflict with Mars, including 14 different scenarios about what we do if they develop an unexpected new technology. The binder for what we do if something comes up from Venus, it's 3 pages long. And it begins, step one, find God."
Aaron Wright looked sober. She could hear Sorin behind her, a different and more anxious silence than he usually carried. She'd laid her fear out on the table.
3 options, she said softly. 1, Mars made it. That's just war. We can handle that. 2, someone else made it. Unpleasant and dangerous, but solvable. 3, it made itself. And we don't have anything.
"You're going to put more pages in your thin binder," Aaron Wright said. He sounded flippant. He wasn't.
"No, sir, I'm going to find out which of the 3 we're looking at. If it's one of the first 2, I'll solve the problem."
"And if the 3rd?
"Retire," she said. "Let you put some other idiot in charge."
Aaron Wright had known her long enough to hear the joke in her voice. He smiled and tugged absently at his tie. It was a tell of his. He was as anxious as she was. No one who didn't know him would have seen it.
"That's a tightrope. We can't let the conflict on Ganymede become too heated."
"I'll keep it a sideshow," Avasarala said. "No one starts a war unless I say they can."
"You mean unless the Secretary General issues the executive decision and the General Assembly casts an affirming vote?"
"And I'll tell him when he can do that," she said. "But you can give him the news. Hearing it from an old grandma like me makes his dick shrink."
"Well, we can't have that, certainly. Let me know what you find. I'll speak with the speechwriting staff and make certain that the text of his announcement doesn't color outside the lines. And anyone who leaks the video of the attack answers to me," she said. "Anyone who leaks it is guilty of treason and will be tried before a legitimate tribunal and sent to the lunar penal colony for life. Close enough. Don't be a stranger, Christian. We're in difficult times. The fewer surprises, the better."
"Yes, sir," she said. The link died. The screen went dark. She could see herself in it as a smudge of orange topped by the gray of her hair. Sorin was a blur of khaki and white.
"You need more work?"
"No, ma'am. So get the fuck out."
"Yes, ma'am."
She heard his footsteps retreating behind her.
"Sorin!"
"Ma'am?"
Get me a list of everyone who testified at the Eros incident hearings, and run what they said in testimony past the neuropsych analysts, if it hasn't already been. Would you like the transcripts?
Yes, that too.
I'll have them to you as soon as possible. The door closed behind him, and Avasarala sank into her chair. Her feet hurt, and the presentiment of a headache that had haunted her since morning was stepping forward, clearing its throat. The Buddha smiled serenely, and she chuckled at him, as if sharing a private joke. She wanted to go home, to sit on her porch and listen to Arjun practice his piano. And instead, she used her hand terminal rather than the office system to call Arjun. It was a superstitious urge that made her want to keep them separate, even in ways as small as this. He picked up the connection at once. His face was angular, the close-cut beard almost entirely white now. The merriness in his eyes was always there, even when he wept. Just looking at him, she felt something in her breast relax. "I'm going to be late coming home," she said, immediately regretting the matter-of-fact tone. Arjun nodded. "I am shocked beyond words," he said. Even the man's sarcasm was gentle. "The mask is heavy today." The mask, he called it. As if the person she was when she faced the world was the false one, and the one who spoke to him or played painting games with their granddaughters was authentic. She thought he was wrong, but the fiction was so comforting, she had always played along. "Today, very heavy. What are you doing now, love?" "Reading Kukri's thesis draft. It needs work." "Are you in your office?"
"Yes."
"You should go to the garden," she said.
"Because that's where you want to be? We can go together when you're home."
She sighed.
"I may be very late," she said. "Wake me, and we can go then."
She touched the screen, and he grinned as if he'd felt the caress. She cut the connection. By long habit, they didn't tell each other goodbye. It was one of a thousand small personal idioms that grew from decades of marriage. Avasarala turned to her desk system, pulling up the tactical analysis of the battle on Ganymede, the intelligence profiles of the major military figures within Mars, and the master schedule for the meeting, already half filled in by the generals in the time since her conference. She took a pistachio from her purse, cracked its shell, and let the raw information wash over her, her mind dancing through it. In the window behind her, other stars struggled through the light pollution of The Hague. But Venus was still the brightest. Chapter 6. Holden. Holden was dreaming of long, twisting corridors filled with half-human horrors, when a loud buzzing woke him to a pitch-black cabin. He struggled for a moment with the unfamiliar straps on the bunk before he unbuckled and floated free in the microgravity. The wall panel buzzed again. Holden pushed off the bed to it and hit the button to bring the cabin lights up. The cabin was tiny. A 70-year-old crash couch above a personal storage locker crammed up against one bulkhead, a toilet and sink built into a corner, and across from the bunk, a wall panel with the name Somnambulist etched above it. The panel buzzed a third time. This time, Holden hit the reply button and said, "Where are we, Naomi?" "Final braking for high orbit. You're not going to believe this, but they're making us queue up."
"Queue up, as in get in line?"
"Yep," Naomi said. "I think they're boarding all the ships that are landing on Ganymede."
shit. Shit, which side is it? Does it matter? Well, Holden said, Earth wants me for stealing a couple thousand of their nuclear missiles and handing them over to the OPA. Mars just wants me for stealing one of their ships. I assume those carry different penalties. Naomi laughed. They'd lock you up for eternity either way. Call me pedantic, then. The group we're in line for look like UN ships, but a Martian frigate is parked right next to them, watching the proceedings. Holden gave a private prayer of thanks for letting Fred Johnson back on Tycho, talk him into taking the recently repaired somnambulist to Ganymede, rather than trying to land on the Rocinante. The freighter was the least suspicious ship in the OPA fleet right now. Far less likely to draw unwanted attention than their stolen Martian warship. They'd left the Rossi parked 1,000,000 kilometers away from Jupiter in a spot no one was likely to look. Alex had the ship shut down except for air recycling and passive sensors, and was probably huddled in his cabin with a space heater and a lot of blankets waiting for their call. Okay, I'm on my way up. Send a tight beam to Alex and let him know the situation. If we get arrested, he's to take the Rossi back to Tycho. Holden opened the locker under the bunk and pulled out a badly fitting green jumpsuit with somnambulist stenciled on the back and the name Phillips on the front pocket. According to the ship's records, provided by the tech wizards back at Tycho, he was crewman First Class Walter Phillips, engineer and general tool pusher on the food freighter somnambulist. He was also third in command out of a crew of three. Given his reputation in the solar system, it was thought best that Holden not have a job on the ship that would require him to speak to anyone in authority. He washed up in his tiny sink, no actual free-flowing water, but a system of moist towels and soaped pads, scratching unhappily at the scraggly beard he'd been growing as part of his disguise. He'd never tried to grow one before, and was disappointed to discover that his facial hair grew in patches of varying length and curl. Amos had grown a beard as well in an act of solidarity, and now had a lush lion's mane, which he was considering keeping because it looked so good. Holden slid the used towel into its cycling chamber and pushed off toward the compartment hatch and up the crew ladder to the operations deck. Not that it was much of an ops deck. The somnambulist was nearly 100 years old, and definitely at the end of her life cycle. If they hadn't needed a throwaway ship for this mission, Fred's people would probably have just scrapped the old girl out. Her recent run-in with pirates had left her half-dead to begin with. But she'd spent the last 20 years of her life flying the Ganymede to Ceres food run, and she'd show up in the registry as a regular visitor to the Jovian moon, a ship that might plausibly arrive with relief supplies. Fred thought that with her regular arrivals at Ganymede, she might just get waved past any customs or blockades without a look. That, it seemed, had been optimistic. Naomi was belted into one of the operations stations when Holden arrived. She wore a green jumpsuit similar to his, though the name on her pocket read Estancia. She gave him a smile, then waved him over to look at her screen. That's the group of ships that are checking everyone out before they land. Damn, Holden said, zooming the telescopic image in to get a better look at the hulls and identifying marks. Definitely UN ships. Something small moved across the image from one of the UN ships to the heavy freighter that was currently at the front of the line. And that looks like a boarding skiff. Well, good thing you haven't groomed in a month, Naomi said, tugging at a lock of his hair. With that bush on your head and that awful beard, your own mothers wouldn't recognize you. I'm hoping they haven't recruited my mothers, Holden said, trying to match her lightness of tone. I'll warn Amos that they're coming. Holden, Naomi, and Amos waited in the short locker-filled hallway just outside the inner airlock door
for the boarding party to finish cycling the lock. Naomi looked tall and stern in her freshly washed captain's uniform and magnetic boots. Captain Estancia had skippered the Somnambulist for 10 years before the pirate attack that took her life. Holden thought Naomi made a suitably regal replacement. Behind her, Amos wore a jumpsuit with a chief engineer's patch and a bored scowl. Even in the microgravity of their current orbit around Ganymede, he seemed to be slouching. Holden did his best to emulate his stance and his half-angry expression. The airlock finished cycling, and the inner doors slid open. 6 Marines in combat armor and a junior lieutenant in an environment suit clanked out on mag boots. The lieutenant quickly looked over the crew and checked them against something on his hand terminal. He looked as bored as Amos did. Holden guessed that this poor junior officer had been stuck with the shit duty of boarding ships all day, and was probably in as big a hurry to be done as they were to leave. Rowena Estancia, captain and majority owner of the series registered freighter Weeping Somnambulist. He didn't make it a question, but Naomi replied, "Yes, sir." "I like the name," the lieutenant said without looking up from his terminal. "Sir?" "The ship name. It's unusual. I swear if I board one more ship named after someone's kid or the girl they left behind after that magical weekend on Titan, I'm going to start fining people for general lack of creativity." Holden felt a tension begin at the base of his spine and creep up toward his scalp. This lieutenant might be bored with his job, but he was smart and perceptive, and he was letting them know it up front. "Well, this one is named after the tearful 3 months I spent on Titan after he left me," Naomi said with a grin. "Probably a good thing in the long term. I was going to name her after my goldfish." The lieutenant's head snapped up in surprise. Then he began laughing. "Thanks, Captain. It's the first laugh today. Everyone else is scared shitless of us. And these 6 slabs of meat," he gestured at the Marines behind him, "have had their senses of humor chemically removed." Holden shot a look to Amos. "Is he flirting with her? I think he's flirting with her." Amos's scowl could have meant anything. The lieutenant tapped something on his terminal and said, "Protein, supplements, water purifiers, and antibiotics. Can I take a quick look?" "Yes, sir," Naomi said, gesturing toward the hatch. "Right this way." She left, the UN officer and 2 of the Marines in tow. The other 4 settled into alert guard poses next to the airlock. Amos elbowed Holden to get his attention, then said, "How you boys doing today?" The Marines ignored him. "I was saying to my buddy here, I bet those fancy tin suits those boys wear bind up something awful in the crotch." Holden closed his eyes and started sending psychic messages to Amos to shut up. It didn't work.
"I mean, all that fancy high-tech gear strapped on everywhere, and the one thing they don't allow for is scratching your balls. Or, God forbid, you get out of alignment and gotta give the works a shift to create some space."
Holden opened his eyes. The Marines were all looking at Amos now, but they hadn't moved or spoken. Holden shifted to the back corner of the room and tried to press himself into it. No one even glanced in his direction.
"So," Amos continued, his voice full of companionable good cheer, "I got this theory and I was hoping you boys could help me out."
The closest Marine took a half step forward, but that was all.
"My theory is," Amos said, "that to avoid that whole problem, they just go ahead and cut off all those parts that might get caught up in your suit. And it has the added benefit of reducing your temptation to diddle each other during those long, cold nights on the ship."
The Marine took another step, and Amos immediately took one of his own to close the distance. With his nose so close to the Marine's armored faceplate that his breath fogged the glass, Amos said, "So, be straight with me, Joe. The outside of those suits, that's anatomically correct, ain't it?" There was a long, tense silence that was finally broken when someone cleared his throat at the hatch and the lieutenant came into the corridor. "There a problem here?" Amos smiled and stepped back. "Nope. Just getting to know the fine men and women my tax dollars help pay for." "Sergeant?" the lieutenant said. The Marine stepped back. "No, sir, no problem." The lieutenant turned around and shook Naomi's hand. "Captain Estancia, it has been a pleasure. Our people will be radioing you with landing clearance shortly. I'm sure the people of Ganymede will be grateful for the supplies you're bringing."
"Happy to help," Naomi said, and gave the young officer a brilliant smile.
When the UN troops had cycled back through the airlock and flown away on their skiff, Naomi let out a long breath and began massaging her cheeks. If I had to smile 1 second longer, my face was going to crack apart. Holden grabbed Amos by the sleeve.
"What the fuck," he said through gritted teeth, "was that all about?"
"What?" Naomi said. "Amos here did just about everything he could to piss the Marines off while you were gone. I'm surprised they didn't shoot him, and then me half a second later." Amos glanced down at Holden's hand, still gripping his arm, but made no move to pull free.
"Cap, you're a good guy, but you'd be a shitty smuggler."
"What?" Naomi said again.
"The captain here was so nervous, even I started to think he was up to something. So I kept the Marines' attention until you got back," Amos said. "Oh, and they can't shoot you unless you actually touch them or draw a weapon. You were a UN Navy boy, you should remember the rules."
"So," Holden started, "so," Amos interrupted, "if the lieutenant asks them about us, they'll have a story to tell about the asshole engineer who got in their faces and not the nervous guy with the patchy beard who kept trying to hide in the corner."
"Shit," Holden said. "You're a good captain and you can have my back in a fight anytime, but you're a crap criminal. You just don't know how to act like anyone but yourself."
"Want to be captain again?" Naomi said. "That job sucks." "Ganymede Tower, this is Somnambulist repeating our request for a pad assignment," Naomi said. "We've been cleared by the UN patrols, and you've had us holding in low orbit for 3 hours now." Naomi flicked off her mic and added, "Asshole." The voice that replied was different from the one they'd been requesting landing clearance from for the last few hours. This one was older and less annoyed.
"Sorry, Somnambulist. We'll get you into the pattern as soon as possible. But we've had launches nonstop for the last 10 hours, and we still have a dozen ships to get off of the ground before we start letting people land."
Holden turned on his mic and said, "We talking to the supervisor now?"
"Yep, Senior Supervisor Sam Snelling, if you're making notes for a complaint. That's Snelling with 2 L's.
"No, no," Holden replied, "not a complaint. We've been watching the outgoing ships flying by. Are these refugee ships? With the tonnage we've seen lifting off, it looks like half the moon is leaving."
"Nope, we do have a few charters and commercial liners taking people off, but most of the ships leaving right now are food freighters."
"Food freighters?"
"We ship almost 100,000 kilos of food a day, and the fighting trapped a lot of those shipments on the surface. Now that the blockade is letting people through, they're on their way out to make their deliveries."
"Wait," Holden said. "I'm waiting to land with relief food supplies for people starving on Ganymede, and you're launching 100,000 kilos of food off the moon?"
"Closer to 500,000, what with a backup," Sam said. "But we don't own this food. Most of the food production on Ganymede is owned by corporations that aren't headquartered here. A lot of money tied up in these shipments. Every day it sat on the ground here, people were losing a fortune."
"I," Holden started, then, after a pause, said, "Somnambulist out." Holden turned his chair around to face Naomi. Her expression was closed in a way that meant she was as angry as he was. Amos, lounging near the engineering console and eating an apple he'd stolen from their relief supplies, said, "This surprises you, why, Captain?" An hour later,